This is audio clips of the book, Onboard UFO Encounters, True Accounts of Contact with Extraterrestrials. Preston Dennett. Quotes from the witnesses. It's changed my life. To be that close to something that is not from here, it's changed the way I think and feel. I don't know how else to explain it except to say that it's on my mind, not constantly, but a lot. I think about these things a lot of the time. Tony. They took thousands of people, and they weren't bringing them back. And he would miss them. Pat. I noticed a disc just hovering the dot. There were portholes going all around the disc. It kind of tilted downward, and I could see like a railing at the midsection of it. There were these people, but their arms were longer than regular arms. And they waved back at us. Ramon. I always thought there were extraterrestrials out there. When it happened to me, I am convinced. I am very solidly convinced of it now. Kim, I didn't know what they were. These things used to come out of my closet. I thought they were monsters. They were small, dark gray, and they were really pushy. I was a very passive child. So, whatever they tell me to do, I would do. They told me to get out of the bed and go. And they'd take me. Lynette. I went in their ship and looked around in it. I talked to them. They wanted to know if I wanted to go with them. Paul, I was so excited. I've never been that awake in my life. I was so in the moment, and I remember it so vividly. I was not the least bit afraid. I was totally enthusiastic and excited and hoping they would land. James. I'll put it for you this way, honey. It was not enjoyable. I would not be in my room, but on this gurney, or on this table, like an examining table, being observed by these forms or whatever was around me. I knew I had to get out of there. Teresa. I kept telling myself, that can't be what I think it is. That can't be. And I had the most sickening repulsive feeling in my stomach. I wanted to go somewhere and hide. I kept shaking my head and saying, no, no, no. They don't exist. Those things just don't exist. Joe. They appeared human. One was taller than the other. I could only see silhouettes though. I could only see them from the waist up. They didn't look like the greys so often described. They just looked like regular humans peering out at me. Ron, I was lying on a metal table. I looked up and saw this big window, and a bench in front of the window. It had round edges, and it was attached to the floor. And I thought, what's happening? Am I in a hospital? Andy, when I realized what I was looking at, it scared me bad. All I could think to do was dive down to the floor and go under my bed. Just as I started to make that turn, my entire room became shockingly bright white blue light. It was so bright it was blinding. I guess I passed out. That's the last thing I remembered. Dolly. I can tell you that the walls on the inside of this thing, from what I can recall, are absolutely smooth, like no texture to it whatsoever, like you were rubbing not even glass. It was smoother than glass. Not really shiny, just silvery metallic looking. It was absolutely smooth. Tim, they sneak around in your room at night. I still have this thing where I don't like to see the closet door open, and I really don't like to see it open at night most of the time. I really don't know what they're doing. A. Mostly just seem to be interested in my reproductive system and DNA, and all that. It's pretty bizarre and frightening. And though I only saw behind me for a few moments, I remember what I saw vividly. The place we were in was enormous, more a small warehouse than a large room, and everywhere you looked, the floor was filled with bodies, some laying still, others writhing about in pleasure. Both men and women. The feeling I got was, I really, really wasn't supposed to see this. Gary. Introduction. This book presents 15 true first-hand cases of people who have been taken on board a UFO and met extraterrestrials face to face. All of the cases are new, original and unpublished. In 1986, I was dragged involuntarily, kicking and screaming, into the UFO field. On November 17th of that year, Japanese commercial airline pilot, Captain Kenju Teruoki and his crew saw a UFO over Alaska. The sighting made the evening news, and it was just barely compelling enough to find a way past my skepticism. Intrigued, I began to ask the people around me what they thought about this crazy pilot. Imagine my surprise when I found out that several of my friends, family and co-workers had experienced UFO encounters. In some of these cases, there was face-to-face contact, or missing time. I couldn't believe it. I felt scandalized. I loved and trusted these people, only to discover that they were keeping secrets from me. Finding out UFOs were real was like being hit by a ton of bricks. It was not good news. I had to reevaluate everything I thought I knew about the world. I became obsessed. I was determined to get to the bottom of this UFO mystery and find out the truth. I joined every UFO group, attended all the meetings, subscribed to the magazines and journals, went to conventions to hear the experts. I became a field investigator for the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON, and began interviewing witnesses. I went out into the field and saw UFOs myself. Before long, I was writing articles and books, speaking at conventions, appearing on the radio, going on TV. Decades later, I'm still investigating new cases and collecting the countless pieces of the UFO jigsaw puzzle, trying to form a comprehensive picture. There are a lot of aspects to the UFO phenomenon. It's deceptively complicated. But I have always felt that the most interesting area of UFO research are cases of direct contact. While seeing a UFO is undeniably interesting, being taken on board a craft and actually meeting ETs face to face is the ultimate UFO experience. An onboard encounter reveals a goldmine of information about UFOs and the beings inside them. Each chapter of this book focuses on one person who has had an onboard UFO encounter. None of the 15 cases in this book have been published before. These 15 cases are among the most extensive in my files, and reveal, I think, considerable information about UFOs and their agenda on our planet. They also show how truly strange the phenomenon can be. Some of the cases, I think, will shock even UFO researchers. At least a few of the cases challenged my own beliefs about the nature of the UFO phenomenon. And yet, despite their fantastic elements, they are all true. The witnesses whose stories are portrayed in this book are normal, everyday people. A nurse, a factory worker, an army officer, an artist, a sports instructor, a warehouse packer, an entertainer, a waitress, a garde tailor, a school custodian, a mechanic. They are no different from anyone else except for one small detail. Each of them carries the secret knowledge of having been on board a UFO. While onboard UFO encounters do follow a general pattern, they are also unique to the individual who experiences them. Some cases are decidedly positive, while others are frightening. One thing the witnesses agree upon: these are neither dreams nor fantasies, nor hoaxes, hallucinations or misperceptions. These are real experiences involving real people. Some of them carry the physical scars attesting to the veracity of their experiences. Some owe their very lives to their encounters. Each witness in this book has confronted ETs directly, face to face. A wide variety of ET types are described, including greys, reptilians, praying mantis, human-looking figures, hybrids, humanoids, and more. Many of the witnesses were able to converse with the ETs and receive considerable information. Almost without exception, the witnesses describe a lifetime of contact, and provide numerous astounding accounts of how extraterrestrials have intervened in their lives. Seeing a UFO or being taken on board is not an isolated event. It is something that many of these witnesses describe happening on multiple occasions throughout their entire lives. A few important notes. Of the 15 cases, only one involves the use of hypnotic regression to recall events, and it easily stands up without the use of hypnosis. The conversations and events described in this book are all true and are taken directly and entirely from extensive interviews with the witnesses. Some of the names have been changed to protect the privacy of those involved. Other witnesses have courageously allowed their real names to be used. What is it like to be taken on board a UFO? Why are the ETs here? How many people are they taking? What is their agenda? The answers are in the pages that follow. Chapter 1, Star Daughter. Around 9 o'clock one evening in 1963, 17-year-old Tony Ditata walked through the neighborhood near his home in Brentwood, New York. Looking up, he saw something very unusual in the sky, a black disc about 40 feet wide, with a red light spinning around the perimeter. "It was an awesome thing to see," says Tony. "It was quite large. It was at treetop level and maybe a quarter mile away. The craft moved slowly, smoothly, and in perfect silence. Because it was so low, the craft disappeared from view behind various houses." Tony had been painting his house and had a ladder ready. He ran home, climbed to the roof of his house and managed to observe the craft for a few more moments, until it disappeared behind a house and was gone. Tony was stunned. The object was clearly unusual. Could it have been an actual UFO? 4 years later, in 1967, around age 21, Tony had a close-up sighting of a gray alien. There was a small park in the middle of Brentwood. It was a popular place in the community and attracted visitors of all types, including Tony and his friends. A hidden gully in the back of the park provided a perfect place to hide out, share a six-pack and spend the evening, talking, joking and having fun. On this night, Tony and about eight other friends were hanging out. None had any money for beer, so with nothing else to do, they decided to explore the golf course, situated adjacent to the park. Around midnight, Tony decided to go home. All the other guys, except Tony's friend, John, went to stay at Dave's house, as he lived right next to the golf course. Tony and John decided to sleep at their own homes. The others left while Tony and John sat on a park bench looking over the green and talking. They watched a man walk by with his dog. Moments later, they heard a strange jingling sound, like a dog's collar or car keys. Looking up, about 40 feet away, was a gray alien standing on the green, facing them. "It looked like it was wearing a one-piece running suit," says Tony. "It was the dull side of aluminum foil." Tony and John stood up, looked at each other and back at the strange figure. The ET turned away from the young men and began to move away. It went right down the middle of the golf course. We could see the thing. It was moving fast enough that it should have been running, but there was no movement, no bounce, and I don't remember seeing its legs moving. It was like the golf course was covered in ice, or it was moving on wheels. It was moving faster than a human could run. Tony and John watched the figure glide at high speed to a grove of three tall pine trees about a quarter mile away. Another gray alien emerged from behind one of the trees, and the two ETs first turned to face each other, and then continued to float down the middle of the course, away from the witnesses. Freaked out and eager to share their experience, Tony and John immediately took off to Dave's house. When they arrived, they were shocked to find that all the other kids were asleep. It had been less than an hour, they thought. Seeing everyone was asleep, they returned home. It never occurred to either of them that they might have had missing time. Strangely, Tony and John discussed the incident only once. "I used to see John up in the park almost every day," Tony says. "He was just one of the regulars in the park. I didn't see him again for 3 years and I walked into the Brentwood bowling alley, and there was John sitting at the counter. I said, 'Hey, John.' And he said, 'Hey, Tony. Seen any little green men lately?' And we both laughed, and I never saw him again." Around that same time, Tony found a new girlfriend. One evening they went to meet her friend, Katie. Tony told Katie about his encounter on the golf course, and learned that Katie's brother had a bedroom which overlooked the golf course. Katie's brother said that about 3 years ago, around the same time of Tony's encounter, he had seen a large disc-shaped object with 11 little men walking around underneath picking things up. Tony was amazed. He wanted to follow up the story and talk to Katie's brother, but never did. In 1969, Tony and his new girlfriend decided to go to Lake Ronkonkoma in Long Island, New York. It was a beautiful natural spot in the woods, just a 15-minute drive from the city. It was a popular spot for young lovers to sit under the stars and talk or become more intimate. "This one night," Tony says, "we're sitting out and talking, and I look up in the sky and see two white discs. These two discs seem to be locked together, and they went from one horizon to the other inside of 20 seconds. There was no way you could miss them. They were pure white bright light, but no sound at all. Tony estimates that the objects were several thousand feet high, and must have been quite large to be so brilliant. It was just a quick flyby, but once again, alerted Tony to the fact that something was out there. Years passed. He took a job at a factory. Later, he worked as a car detailer, and would help recondition cars at a Mercedes dealership in Smithtown. He got married, and lived in a home not far from the golf course, a fact which made Tony a little nervous. I used to close the bedroom door at night, and put little things on the doorknob so that if the door opened, it would wake me up. Tony didn't understand his fear of invaders, not at first. His anxieties were sometimes severe. Silence made him anxious, as did darkness. He slept best with the lights on and some kind of background noise. He always seemed to have an unexplained underlying fear of someone sneaking up on him. At one point he went to a doctor, who diagnosed him with PTSD. Tony was confused. There was no logical reason he could think of that he would have post-traumatic stress disorder. Then, he started to remember something strange. He wasn't sure where the memory came from or what had prompted it to appear, or even when. It seemed like it had always been there, he just hadn't thought about it. But the memory was vivid and sharp. He clearly recalled being on board a UFO. He couldn't remember the act of being taken or returned, but the actual onboard segment was vivid in his mind. As best as he could estimate, the incident occurred when he was 14 years old, a few years before he had seen his first UFO. Now that the memory had surfaced, he couldn't ignore it any longer. I remember being on a ship, being on board, says Tony. I'm sitting on the edge of a table with my legs dangling over. And I don't know what happened. I'm in my underwear only. The table appeared to be about 7 feet long and fixed to the floor. The room was small and lit with a mild, yellow pastel light that seemed to come from no discernible source. There were no corners, with the floor and ceiling being rounded to the walls. There was a large cabinet-like structure alongside one of the walls. The temperature of the room seemed normal. As Tony sat there wondering about his situation, what he now recognizes as a gray alien walked into the room. He put his hand on my left knee, says Tony, and he looked into my eyes. I looked into his. He was maybe 12 inches from my face, and as I'm looking at him, his right eye twitches, like a nervous twitch, and for some reason that sticks in my mind, as if to say this is an alive, living creature. At this point, Tony felt no fear, but was having trouble understanding what was happening. This thing was so close to my face, there must have been communication, but I don't remember any. I don't remember anything telepathic or verbal. I don't remember any sounds. He took me out of the room and we walked out the doorway, which was not a typical door. And it seemed like it was some kind of control room or flight deck. I don't know what to make of it. There was a desk thing. There were two other beings in the room. At this point, Tony's memory fades and he doesn't recall what happened next. He feels certain, however, that the memory is valid. He later had the opportunity to talk to an old childhood friend about it. His friend told him, "You always talked about aliens, UFOs and flying saucers." "I did," Tony replied. "Really?" He didn't recall ever talking about it to anyone. He didn't even remember it until much later. "Yes," his friend said. "You always used to talk about that stuff." Tony was surprised. What was going on? Had he been abducted by aliens? There seemed to be no other answer. He did some research and found that there was a local UFO group in his area, headed by John Ford. The Long Island UFO group held monthly meetings on Long Island. Tony began attending the meetings. He learned that his experience was not unique. He discovered other descriptions of the gray aliens that matched nearly exactly what he saw. One evening during the UFO meetings, John Ford spoke with Tony, and learning of his situation, offered to have him hypnotically regressed to uncover any lost memories. Intrigued by the idea that there was information locked away in his head, Tony agreed. It was the mid-1980s when Tony experienced three sessions of regressive hypnosis. The first two sessions each lasted 40 minutes. The final session lasted nearly 2 hours. To Tony's surprise, the information obtained from the sessions had nothing to do with his childhood memory of being on board a UFO. Instead, he was taken to another incident, a strange mystery that had occurred several years ago. Tony and his girlfriend, soon to be his wife, often traveled to upstate New York, to the Catskills and the Adirondacks. They enjoyed getting away from the crowded city and the drive through the beautiful scenery. On this particular occasion, something strange happened. They had turned off the main interstate, and onto the side roads. When they emerged back into civilization, morning had already arrived and they found themselves behind a building, parked in a parking lot. Feeling only slightly disoriented, they decided they must have gotten lost or distracted. They went to the front of the building and discovered they were at a small diner. They went inside, had breakfast and thought nothing of it. Now, years later, while under hypnosis, Tony found himself back on that same trip with his girlfriend, turning off the main highway. He wasn't sure what prompted him to exit the highway, but he found himself driving on a small two-lane road. Around 1 a.m., they passed a man driving his tractor down the road, towing a trailer. Shortly after passing him, they came upon a thick low-lying fog covering the road. The road headed into a moderate decline. Suddenly Tony slammed on the brakes, actually standing up inside the car and on the brake pedal. Ahead of them, the road appeared to be completely submerged underwater. The car skidded to a stop. With no memory of how he got there, he now found himself standing in a large open field. His girlfriend stood next to him and in front of them was a disc. "I don't know how to describe the size," says Tony. "It was tremendous. This thing made a 747 look like a Piper Cub. It was absolutely gigantic." At this point, Tony saw that there were four gray aliens. Two stood on either side of his girlfriend and began to escort her into the craft, while two stood on either side of Tony, and they followed. "They're leading us towards this disc on the ground," explains Tony. An opening appeared in the craft, revealing a long, curved tunnel leading to the interior. It reminded Tony of a jetway. Tubes of yellow light ran along the base. The interior was black, and felt like rubber. As they walked on board, Tony could see the back of his girlfriend and the ETs walking with her. "We get to the end of this walkway," says Tony, "and there's a column at the end of each side, about 12 feet tall. And there's some kind of writing on the columns, going from top to bottom, not really hieroglyphic looking, or Chinese or Japanese, but along those lines. And this opens up to a very large open area. And not far from where we walk in, there is a being standing there." Powerful emotions of awe swept through Tony. The being stood 8 feet tall and appeared to be wearing a robe. The room was not fully lit, and he could see that he was looking at a living creature, yet the being's appearance was somewhat shrouded. "I can't see what he looks like," says Tony. The next thing he knew, it was 6 o'clock in the morning and he was parked behind the diner. The entire scenario emerged under hypnosis. Tony was shocked. He remembered the trip well, but he had never realized that his journey had been interrupted. Everything had been completely buried. By this point, Tony was convinced that he was an abductee. He had seen UFOs twice and had a fully conscious encounter with a gray, and also recalled being on board a UFO as a child. Now that this other experience had emerged under hypnosis, he realized that he was part of some strange alien agenda. After coming to that realization, he began to examine some strange childhood experiences in a new light. In 1958, when he was about 12 years old, he went to visit his friend, Billy. That evening, they were alone in the room, sitting on the floor in front of the couch, rolling a model car back and forth. Billy pushed the car toward Tony, and the car rolled under the couch. "There was a skirt around the bottom of the couch," Tony said. "So, I lifted up the skirting, and I looked under there, and I could see the car. So, I put my hand under the couch and started reaching for the car, and right before the car, I felt a foot. and my hand went up in the instep, and I could feel an ankle and a leg. It was not human. The ankle and leg seemed to be thin, and I don't want to say scaled, but just not right, not skin. It wasn't skin. And it wasn't a shoe or clothing. It was a naked foot. I'm looking right at the car, and there's nothing there, but my hand is feeling this thing. I have no explanation for how this could happen. Whatever was standing there had to be standing right through the couch, as if the couch wasn't there. Tony screamed, pulled his hand out, jumped up and ran out of the house. Billy ran after him. "What's the matter?" he asked. "I felt a foot under the couch," Tony said. Neither of them could explain it. Back at his own home, strange poltergeist-like experiences began to occur. Me and my brother were sitting there watching TV, and this empty box comes sailing out of the room. There was no one downstairs but me and him. There was no one there. And it was like this box was kicked or thrown. It's not like it just slid across the floor. It came sailing out of the room. The stairs were right there. And I ran up the stairs to hit the lights. We both knew there was nothing there. And we looked around and there was nothing there. The brothers weren't alone. Their mother admitted she sometimes heard footsteps in the basement. A few times, she assumed it was Tony or his brother, and she opened the door only to find that nobody was there. Tony has heard the footsteps. Late one evening, he sat there watching TV. He knew that everyone was asleep but himself. And I hear these footsteps outside the door. It's like you stand in front of the door, you take one foot and slide, and you take the other foot and slide it, and come to a stop. That's what I heard. Tony jumped up, flung the door open and hit the hallway light switch. Nothing was there. Later, as an adult, other weird incidents would occur. One time, he was at the Cadillac dealership where he worked. One evening after work, he and a CO worker bought a few beers and sat down inside a 1972 Coupe de Ville. "Something hit the car," says Tony. "The whole car shook from the back end to the front end, sideways. Like a bloody rhino hit the side of the car." "What the hell is that?" his friend asked. "I don't know," Tony said. They both jumped out of the car. There was no way that anybody or anything could get away without you seeing it, and there was nothing there. Nothing was there. For several decades, Tony lived his life without any overt sign that he was a UFO abductee. At some point, he became disabled and had to retire. Then, out of the blue, when he was 66 years old, he had another close-up encounter with a gray. It was July 4, 2011 and he was visiting his brother's house in Tuttle, Oklahoma. "It was out in the boonies really," Tony says. "This was really out in the sticks. There was nothing around. There were houses, but they're not close together." Tony and about 12 other people, all family and friends, enjoyed a barbecue and some fireworks. Afterward, they all went inside and watched TV. Around midnight, Tony decided it was time to go home. He walked toward his car and pressed the key, causing the doors to unlock, and the headlights to come on. At that moment, he saw movement from the corner of his left eye, toward the garage area. "I turned," Tony says, "and there was a gray standing there, about 4 feet tall. I couldn't see from the knees down because it was standing in some tall grass. I stood there and looked at it, and it was looking at me. I wasn't afraid. It didn't seem to be." Tony stared at the gray figure with awe and fascination. It was about 25 feet away. The figure remained perfectly still for at least 30 seconds. "I couldn't understand why it would stand there," says Tony, "and not just run and run away when the headlights came on. It just stood there." The head was large in comparison to the body, larger on top, kind of bulbous and coming to a point toward the chin area. Very slim arms. It seemed to be wearing a one-piece, skin-tight coverall, or it was naked. Finally, it turned and moved away toward the back of the house. "It wasn't running," he says. "It was extremely fast. I can't put into words how it moved. I've never seen anything do what this thing did. It was much faster than I've ever seen anything move, animal or human." It went toward the back of the house in the backyard. There was a 6-foot chain link fence. I saw it jump over the fence. It was like 20 feet in the air. That blew my mind. Tony rushed back inside and stood in front of his brother and his wife and the others.